ebooks!
Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing the story all about the life and career of King Henry VI and now King Edward IV, because their reigns effectively overlap, or do overlap, the Wars of the Roses. We're talking about the Wars of the Roses. So just to recap you where we were last time, the Yorkists, Edward IV, the son in splendour, this son of York, had basically won. There was a Battle of Tewkesbury, which was a decisive Yorkist victory, so we've had that. And then over the next 2, 3, 4 years even, Warwick, the arch-Yorkist kingmaker, Warwick, puts down all sorts of final pockets of Lancastrian revolt and rebellion all over the country. Sometimes they flip back to the Lancastrians. It's far from straightforward. But it's basically a full Lancastrian victory. A full Yorkist victory. Edward IV is the king, sort of completely undisputed king. Even the old king, Henry VI, is just in prison. He's in the tower. They haven't executed him or anything yet. But he's in the tower. He's completely under their power. And the queen, the bad queen, Margaret of Anjou, and the Prince of Wales and Edward are just in exile in France, licking their wounds, hoping to not get murdered or assassinated. So full Yorkist victory at this point. We left off last time when I was talking about Edward's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville, where Warwick and the whole court really had expected the unmarried King Edward IV, young, still in his early 20s, to marry a French princess or some sort of European princess or duchess. But he revealed that actually he was already married to a minor Lancastrian woman, Elizabeth Woodville, who's already got two kids. She's a widow. Her husband had been killed. And she was very, very beautiful. And he'd married her. And so that's it. And Warwick didn't like that. Warwick was becoming too overly powerful as far as Edward was concerned, too overly powerful and too arrogant and too ambitious. So Edward starts putting him aside and putting the Woodville family in positions of power. So in other words, there's quite a large internal power struggle now underneath King Edward, right? The Lancastrians are basically out of the picture for a few years here. They're basically full-blown defeated one way or another, although not entirely defeated. You say the king, the queen, and the Prince of Wales are still alive, but fully defeated, basically. So the Yorkist party itself starts turning on each other one way or another. I shall be reading, as always, from Professor Sir Charles Oman and Sir Winston Churchill. Let's let Churchill continue the story with his chapter all about the adventures of Edward IV. That's what the chapter's called. And we'll start with a bit of an overview about Edward and his character. And just let Churchill tell a bit of the story. He says this, quote, King Edward IV had made good his right to the crown upon the field of battle. He was a soldier and a man of action. In the teeth of danger, his quality was at its highest. In war, nothing daunted or wearied him. Long marches, hazardous decisions, the marshalling of armies, the conduct of battles seemed his natural sphere. The worse things got, the better he became. But the opposite was also true. He was at this time a fighting man and little more. And when the fighting stopped, he had no serious zest for sovereignty. The land was fair. The blood of youth coursed through his veins. All his blood debts were paid. With ease and goodwill, he sheathed his sharp sword. It had won him his crown, now to enjoy life. End quote. So in other words, when his back's up against the wall, when there's battles to be had, he comes to life and is a great man of action. But when there isn't battles to be had, when there is no great power struggle, he takes his foot completely off the gas. Completely. He becomes lazy and indolent. I mean, later in life, he doesn't live all that long. But spoiler alert, he dies of natural causes. But he doesn't live a long, long life. But he gets fat. Right? He gets fat. He overindulges in food and drink and women to some degree, but definitely being lazy and greedy. When he doesn't have to do fighting, when he doesn't have to run around the country and conduct battles and martial armies, he just enjoys himself. Okay. Churchill goes on here saying, the successes of these difficult years had been gained for King Edward by the Neville family, Warwick and Montague, now Earl of Northumberland, with George Neville, Archbishop of York, had the whole machinery of government in their hands. As I say, complete Yorkist victory at this point. The king had been present only at some of the actions. He could even be reproached for his misguided clemency. Because if you remember last time, we talked about how he tried to show mercy and clemency to a few of the Lancastrian rebels. And in the end, that bit him in the ass and he had to take them out anyway. But, you know, he tried. some would say credit for trying, some would say that was dumb. But nonetheless, he tried it, it sort of failed. Churchill said his misguided clemency, which had opened up again the distresses of civil war, his magnanimity had been at length sternly repressed by his counsellors and generals, i.e. reverse course on that, you've got to stamp them out entirely. In the first part of his reign, England was therefore ruled by two brothers, Warwick and Northumberland. So the king's on top, King Edward, the Duke of York, now king, but then under him, Warwick and Warwick's brother, Lord Montague. They're the ones that really do the business of government, that really wield the power and control policy. As long as Edward himself is happy and content and well-fed, he's happy for others to actually control government. Warwick and Lord Montague, the Earl of Northumberland. They believed that they had put the king on the throne and meant him to remain there while they governed. The king did not quarrel with this. In all his reign, he never fought but when he was forced. Then he was magnificent. History has scolded this prince of 22 for not possessing immediately the statescraft and addiction to business to which his office called. Edward united contrasting characters. He loved peace, he shone in war, but he loved peace for its indulgences rather than its dignity. His pursuit of women, in which he found no obstacles, combined with hunting, feasting, and drinking to fill his life. Were these not the rightful prizes of victory? Let Warwick and Northumberland and other anxious lords carry the burden of state, and let the king be merry. That was his thinking. For a while, this suited all parties. The victors divided the spoil, the king had his amusements, and his lords their power and policy. It should have been all good, shouldn't it? Everyone's happy. Could have, should have worked out well. Why not go on like that indefinitely? Well, it wasn't to be. Churchill continues. Thus some years slipped by, while the king, although gripping from time to time the reins of authority, led in the main his life of ease. His mood towards men and women is described in well-chosen words by the staid Hume, who wrote, Churchill's quoting Hume, saying, during the present interval of peace, he lived in the most familiar and sociable manner with his subjects, particularly with the Londoners, and the beauty of his person, as well as the gallantry of his address, which, even unassisted by his royal dignity, would have rendered him acceptable to the fair, facilitated all his applications for their favour. This easy and pleasurable course of life augmented every day his popularity among all ranks of men. He was the peculiar favourite of the young and gay of both sexes. Happy gay, not homosexual gay. The disposition of the English, little addicted to jealousy, kept them from taking umbrage at these liberties, and his indulgence in amusements, while it gratified his inclination, was thus become, without design, a means of supporting and securing his government, i.e. let the powerful and ambitious men under him, let them have their power. That's the end of Hume's quote. Churchill goes on saying, after these comparatively mild censures, the historian proceeds to deplore the weakness and imprudence which led the king to stray from the broad, sunlit glades of royal libertinage onto the perilous precipices of romance and marriage. One day, the king a-hunting was carried far by the chase. He rested for the night at a castle. In this castle, a lady of quality, niece of the owner, had found shelter. Elizabeth Woodville, or Widville, was the widow of Lancastrian knight Sir John Grey, and Sir John Grey was, quote, in Margaret's battle at St. Albans slain. Churchill goes on. Her mother, Jacquetta of Luxembourg, had been the youthful wife of the famous John, Duke of Bedford, and after his death she had married his steward, Sir Richard Woodville, later created Earl Rivers. This condescension, so far below her station, caused offence to the aristocracy, i.e. Richard Woodville was no Duke of Bedford. That's a massive, massive step down, even though he was created an earl, but okay. She was fined £1,000 as a deterrent to others. She was actually disgraced at the aristocracy by marrying a mere knight after being married to a duke. Nevertheless, she lived happily ever after. Yeah, they seem to have genuinely loved each other. And bore her husband no fewer than 13 children, of whom Elizabeth was one. This is our Elizabeth Woodville, to be queen, to be the White Queen of England. There was higher as well as ordinary blood in Elizabeth's veins. She was an austere woman, upright, fearless, chaste and fruitful. Hey, she had children, a bunch of children herself. She and her two sons were all under the ban of the attainder, which disinherited the adherents of Lancaster, because her ex-husband had been staunchly Lancastrian. The chance of obtaining royal mercy could not be missed, i.e. the king's come to stay at their home. This is her chance. perhaps her one and only chance to actually speak to the king himself. And, you know, you can only imagine it's something like, look, yeah, we did used to be Lancastrian, sure, but we're sorry now. You know, my husband's dead now. He paid the ultimate price, didn't he? How long were we to be completely disinherited and punished forever? We're on board with the Yorkists now. We recognise you as king now. We're loyal to you now. Can you let us off? Is there anything that can be done? Plus, she's extremely beautiful, apparently. And Edward loves the women's. Okay, Churchill says, the chance of obtaining royal mercy could not be missed. The widow bowed in humble petition before the youthful conqueror, and like the tanner's daughter of Falaise, that'll be William the Conqueror's mother. William the Conqueror's mother was a bit of a peasant, but she caught the eye of a duke, William of Normandy's father. She just caught his eye and he decided, right, you, I'm marrying you. I don't care that you're a peasant, that you're a tanner's daughter. Like the tanner's daughter of Falaise, made at first glance the sovereign her slave. So he fell in love with her immediately. She was that beautiful. Shakespeare's account, though somewhat crude, does not err in substance. The Lady Elizabeth observed the strictest self-restraint, which only enhanced the passion of the king. He gave her all his love, and when he found her obdurate, i.e. she's not immediately returning his affection, he besought her to share his crown. He spurned the counsels of prudence and worldly wisdom. He loads of people around him saying, calm down, bro, don't marry her. What are you doing? That's mad. Like, it's not worth it. Okay. Why conquer in battles? Why be a king if not to gain one's heart's desire? That was Edward's response. Yeah, what's the point in being king if you can't do what you want? If you can't choose the woman you want to marry, what's the point in being at the top of things if you can't even do that? But he was well aware of the dangers of his choice. His marriage in 1464 with Elizabeth Woodville was a secret guarded in deadly earnest. The statesmen at the head of the government, while they smiled at what seemed an amorous frolic, never dreamed it was a solemn union which must shake the land to its depths. End quote. Because, yeah, I mean, Edward was known as a womanizer. Everyone around him would have thought Elizabeth Woodville was just one more of those, right? But it wasn't to be. Churchill goes on saying, Warwick's plans for the king's future had been different. Warwick thinks he can control the king now. A few years down the line, what, 3, 4, 5 years after Tewkesbury, Warwick thinks he's just so used to wielding power and being extremely popular and powerful in the land. He's starting to think he can just tell the king what to do and what to think, where to go, and all that sort of thing. Well, Edward, he might be lazy and indolent when there's nothing to do, but he's not a fool. He's not a pushover at all. Not at all. But Warwick starts to think that he might be. So, okay. Warwick's plans for the king's future had been different. Isabella of the House of Spain, or preferably a French princess, were brides who might greatly forward the interests of England. A royal marriage in those days might be a bond of peace between two neighbouring states or the means of successful war. Warwick used grave arguments and pressed the king to decide. Edward seemed strangely hesitant and dwelt upon his objections until the minister, who was also his master, became impatient. Warwick doesn't know about the secret marriage. No one really does. Well, not no one. Very, very, very few people know about the secret marriage to Elizabeth Woodville. And the kingmaker, Warwick himself, is not in on it. And he doesn't get why Edward is sort of umming and ahhing, being like, oh, I might marry a French princess, I might not, I don't know, there's no need to right now, is there? And in the end, Warwick starts, as Churchill just said there, starts becoming impatient, starts trying to tell Edward what to do, like explicitly. It's like, okay, you are doing this now. Okay, I am just going to arrange for you to go and meet a French princess or bring a Spanish princess over here for you to meet or whatever. I'm going to start putting things in motion for you to get married, okay? And Edward's like, he's not playing along with it. Okay, the minister started to become impatient. Then at last, the truth was revealed to all. He had for 5 months been married to Elizabeth Woodville. Here then was the occasion which sundered him from the valiant kingmaker, 14 years older, but also in the prime of life. Warwick had deep roots in England, and his popularity, whetted by the lavish hospitality which he offered to all classes upon his great many estates, was unbounded. The Londoners looked to him. He held the power. But no one knew better than he that there slept in Edward a tremendous warrior, skilful, ruthless, and capable when roused of attempting and of doing all. End quote. Yeah, so Edward, you know, again, when it comes to it, remember the Tewkesbury and all the battles before that. If and when it came to it, he is probably a better general than you, almost certainly a better general than you, probably a better organizer than you, definitely a better warrior, an actual fighter in actual combat, probably got more energy than you, probably more wily than you. He might seem like a little puppy at the moment. He just, all he wants to do is eat and drink and fornicate. But if it comes to it, and utterly ruthless, again, after a battle, he will just, more or less in cold blood, execute everyone. Right? He's a badass individual. You know, don't be mistaken. Just because at the moment he likes to spend his days doing nothing, really, that doesn't mean he's not extremely capable. All right, so Churchill continues here saying, the king too, for his part, began to take more interest in affairs, the affairs of government, that is. Queen Elizabeth had 5 brothers, 7 sisters, and 2 sons. By royal decree, he raised them to high rank, i.e. all these Rivers, the Rivers family, the Woodville family, same thing. All these brothers, they all get given higher jobs, and even her 2 sons once they grow up a bit. They're given high rank or married them into the greatest families. He went so far as to marry his wife's 4th brother at 20 to the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, aged 80. Okay. 8 new peerages came into existence in the Queen's family. Her father, 5 brothers-in-law, her son, and her brother Anthony. Her brother Anthony becomes an important player in all of this. This was generally thought excessive. Oh, yeah, most people watching this, all the aristocracy, you know, everyone in and around the court, they see this lowly Rivers family, the Woodville family, they see them, they're ex-Lancastrians, and not very important at all, suddenly made into one of the most important families in the country, arguably 2nd, 3rd, 4th most important family in terms of pure patronage and influence over the king, the most powerful family outside of the Yorks themselves. Well, even above them, right? The Nevilles, the Warwick, the kingmaker, they're cousins of Edward, Duke of York, and all of his brothers and his immediate family, they're cousins. But the Nevilles, now the Rivers, they've been placed above them even. They've gone from nowhere, and just because Edward wants to, he's made them the most powerful family in the country, more or less, one way or another, could be argued. Okay, that's not going to sit well with everyone else. It's a zero-sum game, right? There's only a certain amount of power and positions to go around, a finite number, very small number, really, and he's given it all to these upstarts. Well, nobody other than them is happy with that, particularly the Nevilles and Warwick the Kingmaker himself. Churchill says, this patronage was generally thought excessive. It must be remembered that at this time, there were but 60 peers, of whom not more than 50 could ever be put to Parliament on one occasion. All these potentates were held in a tight and nicely calculated system. The arrival of a new nobility who had done nothing notable in the war, and now, other than nominally be on the Lancastrian side, and now surrounded the indolent king, was not merely offensive, but politically dangerous to Warwick and his proud associates. But the clash came over foreign policy. In this sad generation, England, lately the master, had become the sport of neighbouring states. Remember, the Hundred Years' War is still almost just about in living memory. Right? The campaigns, the wonderful, brilliantly successful campaigns of Henry V is only like a generation ago, getting on to sort of 2 generations ago, and still just about within living memory. And now we're completely, completely foiled and reversed in France. So it's like an embarrassment for us. Foreign policy, at least as far as France is concerned, on the French front. Okay, on the foreign policy, Churchill said, we'd become the sport of neighbouring states. Her titled refugees, from one faction or the other, beset the courts of Western Europe. The Duke of Burgundy had been shocked to learn one morning that a Duke of Exeter and several other high English nobles were actually begging their bread at the tail of one of his progresses. Ashamed to see a slight upon his class, he provided them with modest dwellings and allowances. Similar charities were performed by Louis XI to the unhappy descendants of the victors of Agincourt, i.e. the sort of the Lancastrians, exiled Lancastrians that have completely lost, really, in England, in mainland England, Wales and Scotland. A lot of them fled to France or Burgundy, and the French sort of take pity on them in some way. Well, they know that it's a thorn in England's side. They're an annoying loose end as far as England is concerned. So help them, give them succour. Why not? If it undermines England, that's always good for France, isn't it? Kind of as simple as that. Churchill says, Margaret, with her retinue of shadows, was welcomed in her pauper stateliness both in Burgundy and in France. At any moment, either power, now become formidable as England had waned, might support the exiled faction in good earnest and pay back the debts of 50 years before an invasion of England. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.